Hi there, and welcome to the Engage Customer Podcast, where you'll discover the latest insights, opinions, and trends within the industry. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Salesforce, the world's number one service platform. With Salesforce, you have a 360-degree view of your customers, empowering agents and making interactions easy for your customers. The result? Deeper customer relationships built on intelligence, empathy, and trust. Visit sfdc.co/customer-service to find out more.
Today, our editorial director, Steve Hurst, is joined by Martin Hill Wilson. Martin is a leading customer engagement and digital business strategist, and an author and international keynote speaker. Working under his own brand, Brain Food Consulting, he designs masterclasses and transformational change, helping clients evolve their social and digital capabilities.
Welcome to the second of our series of podcasts with our friend and partner, Martin Hill Wilson. Following on from our first podcast a few weeks ago, on how to sort of operate during a recession and customer service during a recession. Since we had that conversation, Martin, we've had an announcement of a 20% drop in GDP. So I think the podcast we ran there is even more pertinent.
Well, it is. And that's been a conversation growing in everyone's mind. I think it will just become more intense as people translate that into enterprise budgetary cuts. And what that's going to mean in the area that you belong to, whether it's marketing, sales, service, CX, contact centers, or whatever. And, you know, the basic reality of delivering great customer experience at much, much lower cost is going to become much more in focus for everyone.
And we've got that recording there so for people to look at. So I'm certainly going to listen to it again in the light of the current situation as we move into recession. Martin, you're an author, industry commentator, frequent conference chair and keynote speaker. And I know you've got deep experience in customer strategy from technology to culture, and you're leading at the moment the charge on emotive CX, which focuses on the skill and management process and needs to deliver both functional and emotive needs of the customers. I know that's a really interesting piece of work you're working on, and especially important in these times of heightened anxiety and uncertainty. Now, Martin, our second podcast today is going to be looking at responding to rapidly changing customer needs, which is, again, is a huge topic. And so without further ado, I'm going to go on to my first question to you on this, Martin. How has the pandemic changed consumer priorities and habits?
Yes, thank you for that, Steve. There's a number of points that I want to cover off here, because I think what's interesting is it's not just a slight change in a particular topic or theme. It's a multitude which are all interacting with each other and therefore causing considerable change. So I think the first thing that we can probably all identify with personally is that pandemic has meant that we've been stuck at home, our ability to live our life has changed, or our capacity to do that has had to change, and therefore growth in online activity has been really significant. And I think it's significant for two reasons. One, those of us that were doing it before are obviously doing much more. But we've also seen the introduction of whole new segments of customers, typically probably slightly older consumers at the end of the day. If you look at the States, for example, I think in the March period, there 43% of all online sales were really from this new customer segment. So we've seen a transformation of habits. Now, what's interesting, as we speak at the time of recording, this particular week, we revisited the fact that we could then go physically onto the high street, and quite a few of the high street retailers have opened up. There was a panic, at least according to the way that we watched it on the TV, with, you know, people obviously missed the experience of face-to-face shopping. It remains to be seen how the physical and the online then rebalance at the end of the day. There is some work that's been done by McKinsey suggesting that, in fact, with China, which is slightly ahead of the curve in terms of getting over, although they're getting back into the pandemic again, recovering from that and then seeing their consumers go back into physical shopping, they still found that a significant proportion of what these new segments were about remained as online purchasing. So in other words, that habit has stuck with us and probably is going to continue to stick with us. To come home a little bit more, just to make it real, and you look at, for example, UK grocers, They added more than 500,000 new delivery slots in that sort of same period of time, which is an uplift of 30%. So, you know, first point to be made, obviously, is that online has become huge. It's continued. It's becoming a habit. Even when we go back, if we do, to physical, it's probably going to be a higher base from which to continue to offer that kind of way of engaging with customers. Now, if you look at that from a personal point of view, there's a motivation in there from us as consumers. And again, nicely characterized by a phrase I came across recently called fear of density. Now, not mental density, but social density. I think we mentioned it slightly last time.
Social distancing, yeah.
Yeah, social distancing. So if you start to extrapolate from that and you say consumers are also employees, you know, it may well mean if you look at your environment at work that you're not going to actually open office and open work environments is not going to be so popular. Maybe we go back more to the cubicle environment that we used to have. Clearly, we're going to have some rules to reduce that fear around of things like, you know, the commute, the escalator, the elevator, you know, the skyscraper, all of those kind of environments. How are we going to get people, you know, feeling comfortable as far as that's concerned? And probably the answer is, we're going to share activity between doing it from home and doing it in the bricks and mortar. And what's kind of interesting about that is how that translates then into new opportunity and new segments. So, again, interesting observation that the drive-through fast food may also, as a habit, extend to things like groceries. It might extend, for example, to restaurants. I was having a chat with the guy who's building a couple of houses next door to where I'm living, and you know, he's a well-heeled builder. He's a CEO as well. He does as a pastime builds these kind of executive homes. And there's a very, very nice place that, just local to us at Woburn called the Paris House. You know, and if you want to give yourself a really good treat, you go there, and you will certainly spend more than a couple of hundred quid if you know have the full thing. And interestingly, they've adapted by offering takeaways, which is,
yes,
you know, almost unprecedented. And he said you can get a fabulous chicken pie for about 12 quid from him. You pick it up on the Thursday, and he said it's still worth it because, you know, when you go home and you cook it up, of course, it's still much better than anything you could cook for yourself. And he's done a roaring business, you know, as a result of that. So there's a difference. Again, Milton Keynes, we announced apparently, we're going to be doing drive-through cinema as well, you know, the social distancing.
Yes.
So
yeah,
we need something protective, whether it's a face mask or a car cocooning us. If we're going to be social again, we've got to do it in a way that we kind of feel comfortable. Now, what's then interesting is if we're going to spend more time at home, you know, how's that translated? I don't know any stats on board games, but everybody's told me that they've been playing more board games and stuff.
I think the increase in sales is about 450% immediately post lockdown, Martin. Huge,
really?
Increase in sales,
yes.
Of board games. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So another key thing that we do at home is there's a very close correlation between cooking and spending more time at home. And I think we've got this huge reversal of us always being out, you know, always dining out, always socializing, always whatever. Now we're definitely back at home. And again, an interesting stat from the States saying that cooking had really shrunk to about a minority sport, as with sewing. You know, about only 10% of the population were actually doing it in the States. That's now grown back above 50% during this pandemic period,
yes,
of time.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, so you start to see that, presumably even maybe a healthier lifestyle, but that then drives, you know, a certain kind of purchase as far as the groceries are concerned, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So interestingly, fear of social density is another part of, you know, of that. If you then look, I suppose, into something associated with that is the growth, obviously, on anything to do with hygiene or health or anything as far as that's concerned. And I think there's a theme that I'm going to come back to later on. But again, the way that we as consumers look at the organizations, let's say in retail, and expect them to have done the right thing around of social distancing, you know, hygiene in store. And again, interesting piece of work that KPMG did looking at the Facebook walls of brands located particularly in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And what they discovered from that is that there's a reorganizing of priorities. So, for instance, much more focus upon, as I said, with a retailer or grocer that you could trust the fact that they've got, you know, my best interests at heart around of social distancing, the hygiene stuff. There's relatively less interest, relatively, in the things that were trending very strongly prior to that, which is around the plastic bags, the packaging, the environment and stuff. So that might be temporary, but right now other priorities have kind of risen up to the surface. Again, if you look at another aspect which we used to talk a lot about, restaurant conversations about restaurants, the whole business of having a highly personalized, tailored experience, you know, that has diminished again in relationship to concerns about safety, food hygiene, et cetera, et cetera. And it kind of starts to suggest, you know, we're seeing that translated into sales of certain products if you're looking to P&G and Unilever. So wiping surfaces, washing hands more often, washing clothes more often, sales of vitamin C, which is considered healthy, et cetera, et cetera. All of those product sets have grown sort of massively at this period of time. And probably if you look to that, and then look back at what we now want as consumers, there is a bit of a drift to back to basics.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the CX movement that we've been watching for a decade has all been driving towards trying to exceed expectations. There's a big debate there. Certainly trying to be highly personalized, you know, and deliver everything absolutely picture perfect. We now seem to look more like a sort of a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which says, give me the basics. There's a certain amount of forgiveness in that. And I will trade off on those things more than the things that we were looking at, you know, in the first instance. And that's an interesting, you know, observation, that it's not so much about going beyond and above. It's more about delivering the basics, which will probably also tie into the fact that many of us will find our own purses and budgets reduced in this period of time. So they're going to have to settle for a different kind of level of quality, a different level of luxury, possibly, you know, as a result of that. And then the final thing I think I'd like to say is, with all of that, is that obviously the indications of the hygiene and focus upon health also reflects a certain mindset that we have, and that's one of anxiety and concern. And coming back, as you said earlier on, to the work that I've been doing on emotive CX, you know, this is just simple behavioral psychology to say that when we feel under threat, we do lock down and we do get into a much more binary type of response to our world, where we tend to see much more negative, we tend to see much more threat, you know, at the end of the day. And that translates into some interesting thoughts, which is that people aren't going to be so open, you know, to suggestions and ideas, going to be probably more critical because they see threat. So yeah, whilst there is a degree of forgiveness, also, if your service capability has collapsed, and interestingly, this week I saw a really alarming article about Delta Airlines, where people have been waiting, I think, for 70 days for a refund, 30 days to even get something answered. I don't know what's gone on there. But, you know, they have really got some exceedingly strong negative sentiment, you know, flowing across social networks right now. And you've got to deal with that because, of course, customers are going to exaggerate that particular mindset. The other thing is maybe there's a switch on that thing about trying to protect what you've already got rather than seeing the upside of what you might be able to provide them with. So some of the messaging that brands need to provide back to us is that we are able to help you in terms of keeping what you've already got, you know, keeping your looks, keeping energy, comfort, time, confidence, control, all those kind of bits and pieces. The things that are essential to us, those are probably the things that we're most interested in protecting, rather than having an open mind, rather than having an innovation mindset, rather than being open to new, fresh experiences, which was very much the characteristic of the experience economy up until COVID came and slapped us around the face. So again, you've got quite a significant set of changes, some of them quite physical, some of them cognitive, that are changing. And underneath all of that, you know, you've got an uncertainty which is going to probably continue into the future. And as we speak this week, what's interesting is what's coming around again which is significant not just to China, but for the rest of us watching that situation, is, of course, that Beijing is now under lockdown.
Absolutely. Which, again, gets us to wonder
whether or not this is going to be a permanent phenomenon, in which case, you know, how are we going to deal with that kind of ongoing threat to ourselves, which will keep ourselves in that certain kind of mindset.
Agreed. So I think those are some of the characteristics
that I would say are driving a change pretty much for any type of consumer.
Thanks for that, Martin. So what would you say are the implications for customer insight?
Well, I think the first thing to be said is that we have spent a lot of time collecting voice of customer. We've translated those into personas. You know, we have those as working assumptions for the way that we market, we engage, we understand our markets, we develop value propositions, etc. I would suggest that as a working assumption, many of those are either partially or completely obsolete. If you find that a little strong to take, then I would suggest that at least you consider that the norm is not going to be necessarily true any longer. So everything that you've got in terms of your insight, you should go back on, certainly the major assumptions that you've made about your customers' behaviors, and ask yourself, do they remain true? If you're going to be prudent, I would also suggest that you probably get into some original work with customers of the type that is more qualitative than quantitative to really get under the skin of it and discover, I mean, the 6 points I just went through, how would those translate into your market? Are they true for you in this geography? And if they are, what does that mean for what you're selling and how you're understanding their priorities and indeed how you segment? I mean, one interesting point, going back to the growth in online, if there has been an uptick in older consumers online, that's got to be a huge opportunity. That's a silver lining for, you know, a considerable number of people. But the other idea about the fact that we want to protect what we've got as opposed to experiment with the new, that's also interesting and indicative about how you position, you know, and you talk about the value propositions that you're doing. So voice of customer to me is an essential hygiene factor at this point to check that what you imagine the customer's about is actually the case, because you're going to have less money in the future. You do not want to be experimenting with things which are fundamentally out of kilter. And I think we all recognize, you and I have talked about this in another context quite recently, that actually the best way to stay engaged with customers is to spend as much time as we can online, you know, in the business community. We really don't know what's going on, and we're in a constant state of sitting in Zoom sessions in one form or the other, or online conferences, listening to each other, listening to the use cases and the responses that are coming through, because, you know, there is a whole new set of things that are being developed right now, and there's nobody out there who's foolish enough to say that they actually know with any great degree of certainty what's going down. So voice of a customer isn't a single activity any longer. It's an ongoing pulse, and you're just trying to see what's emergent and how that translates back into your core assumptions about how you do customer engagement.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with John Lewis Partnership just earlier on today, actually, and they're doing a huge amount of work on voice of the customer as we speak. So it's quite interesting.
Absolutely.
Thanks for that, Martin. So I think we've touched on this, but in response to this insight, how are organisations adapting, do you think?
Well, we have talked about this. Let's do the one that I think has been mentioned a lot, which is the, you know, the drive to become fully digital. Which is to say, your ability to exist in any context, if you want, by which I mean you've merged the ability to interact purely online with the ability to do physical. You've merged the ability to be fully automated with the ability to provide the human touch. You have completed that massive project called digital transformation, which somehow tries to bring together workflow, communication, back-end systems, you know, into a single sort of ecosystem. And, you know, all of that is more completed than it ever has been in the last 10 years, you know, at the end of the day. And the interesting point, of course, is that if we link that back to the point we just made about customers and the way that customer needs are evolving and will probably continue to bounce backwards and forwards, you've got to build something which is inherently responsive.
Yes.
So from the IT perspective, cloud is obviously more flexible, scalable, iterative, if you combine that with agile. Microservices are an interesting concept. I was talking to my son, actually, in another context. He's in learning and development, and he's talking about a lot about micro-learning. And it's the same point, which is that you want to take big things and break them into smaller units, because then you can assemble them and disassemble them and reorganize them dynamically. Whereas if you build big, you know, things that can't easily be iterated, that's not the way to go. So in IT terms, things like API as a way of joining things, things like microservices as a way of building things, again, this becomes massively, massively important. And probably the job of business as usual in the future will be as much about of continuous development and testing of the fundamentals as it is as just trying to do the same thing over and over and over. In other words, the playbook of how things should be between us and customers, and even us and suppliers and us and any other stakeholder, will continuously iterate. So you need to have an infrastructure that really allows you, you know, to do that at the end of the day. And then I think back down in the area of purely customer service, I think the thing that matters a lot there is that we try to drive as much automation, as much proactive engagement and self-service to give more headroom to the human touch. You know, there's still far too many organizations finding themselves unable to be responsive, as the example I gave earlier of the American airline, and we've desperately got to be able to make the people side of what we're doing much more valuable and focused upon the things that really matter to customers.
Yeah,
you've got to get rid of a lot of the stupid stuff.
Yeah, that leads me on to my next question, actually, Martin, which again I think we've touched on just briefly there. You know, as everyone from solo entrepreneurs to global brands boost their digital footprint, will our customers grow tired of all the noise?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. Inevitably, yes. I don't know whether or not we touched on it last time, but if I look to my inbox coming on LinkedIn, for example, I don't think I've seen as many invitations to connect coming from salespeople who want to sell me quite the most extraordinary range of things. With hardly any qualification whatsoever, you know. And recently, everybody is my best friend as a solo business, wanting to lend me tons of money.
You've never been so popular.
I've never been so bloody popular in my life. And I have to say, I don't see any discrimination or targeting in that effort at all. Did I say this last time? I can't remember now, but Shopify. You know, which is
mention Shopify last time, but the interesting brand. We've actually had Shopify present at a couple of our events in the past, and they're going places, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and their latest stat was, again, in that magic, you know, accelerated period of March, they saw something like a 450% uptick in you know, adoptions of basic plans and everything, because what they saw, and I think this is probably the first wave of people going, you know, we've got to be entrepreneurial before we get furloughed out of existence. You know, let's get on with it. And so what that really is talking to is the launch of a huge number of, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 person businesses trying to take what they know online, either as products or as services.
Yes, true.
And so you've got now a huge volume, because, you know, any marketplace is always going to be bottom heavy in that sense. You know, the small SME space is always, there's many more of those than there is the big lot. So you combine that with the bigger lot, once you become increasingly digital, et cetera, back to the conversation, you know, with the, you know, the big incumbents like the John Lewis's and stuff, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
And it's entirely possible, you know, that we will become rather exhausted, you know, by it at the end of the day, which means, as with most market evolutions, you know, once you've got to a point where everyone cancels each other out, there's got to be something new that draws my attention.
Agreed.
I think part of the digital push is, of course, that in a digital context, my behavior as a customer, for good or for bad, we'll leave that conversation to aside right now, is visible. And part of the competency of a digital brand is, of course, the use of data as close to the activity of a customer as possible. You know, and with the advent of analytics, predictive, other bits of AI, we're entirely, you know, it's entirely feasible to be able to learn from customer needs and become more appropriate. So the very best brands, ironically, will probably be doing less communication, but far more effective communication because it's personalized and targeted and relevant. And I think that that, again, you know, the way that we'll go, ooh, Deliveroo, ooh, Amazon, ooh, Uber. We'd love the way that that's been clever. I think that consumers will experience that fatigue and they will appreciate brands that are doing much more signal rather than just pure noise. And I think that's going to become important. Otherwise, we're going to find everything being locked down and locked out because, you know, it's just too much.
Very good point, Martin. Very good point. On to the final question, Martin. Is it just about the value proposition or has organizational reaction to social change become more important to customers?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case, yes. And something that I think brands have really got to keep very close attention towards. Some organizations in the past have identified themselves as purpose-driven, i.e. having something greater than simply the product, the value proposition that they're selling. They have exhibited a set of values and translated that into action. And as such, you know, they could be considered to be purpose-driven. And I think that really the customer is expecting us as organizations to increasingly act in those kinds of ways. So I've just got some statistics to bring that kind of observation to life. Here's one, which is an Edelman stat. 90% of customers from across the world, in other words, a damn big figure, believe brands must do everything they can to protect the well-being and financial security of their employees and their suppliers, even if it means suffering big financial losses until the pandemic ends. Now, if you put that stat on the table in a board meeting, it might just get shoved straight off the table. There's an interesting corollary to that, though, and that is that one in three people have already stopped using a brand that they think did not respond well during the pandemic. So that might give you cause to keep it on the table and have a good long think about that. And if you're not doing that, then the key issue is one of trust. And again, same study, 70% of global customers say that if brands are going to behave in this way, they are going to lose my trust forever, you know, and they're not really going to reconsider how they engage with those brands again in the future. Now, on the plus side, organizations that kind of get that, and I would put people like Unilever very strongly in the spotlight, they completely understand that you have got to be a purpose driven, and that's not something you can invent overnight, but if you have not gotten there, you really do need to be reconsidering it. But if you already have momentum in that respect and you can be part of the global debate, then you do need to be sincere in terms of how you execute against things like the pandemic, against things like the social unrest in the States and everything that's been triggered from the death of George Floyd. And just a few quotes to illustrate some of the challenges sitting in there, which were captured from Aline Santos, who's executive VP of the marketing activity in Unilever, when she was sitting down as a virtual roundtable recently with other marketeers. And she said some really interesting things. Brands need to move at the speed of culture, and culture is moving faster than ever. A brand's role in culture has never been more important because people expect us to have a point of view. You don't want to be a footprint in history. And, you know, this is a time when we can see businesses and brands as the biggest healers. We have to take that responsibility. You know, and you've got to do that from an authentic position of what your purpose is. You can't afford to be seen as somebody just jumping on, you know, the bandwagon at the end of the day. But equally, you know, with the notion of the way that Black Lives Matter, there is a notion that says silence is complicity. And that sentiment can easily translate into the brand's position of whether or not they are going to take a position relative to these kinds of issues in an authentic way and therefore deliver what now we expect from these organizations, which is to be transparent, which is to be moral, in a sense, and to have a point of view and also deliver action against that particular thing. And if you consider the role of businesses and how that we're being asked to behave in that respect, that's a real transformation from even 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And that relative to government and the difficulty of believing, you know, many political positions that are going on, the whole era of fake news, organizations are looking quite different. And I would suggest that that is probably the most significant driver that we're going to see moving forward in terms of loyalty and connection to brands and our propensity to either, you know, love them or literally dismiss them on the basis of that behavior, which has got at face value very little to do with, you know, the core value proposition, but everything to do with it, because we want to have relationships with organizations that we feel are positive and reflect what matters to us in life. And I think that's a huge trend, much more so than service levels, and something that we all have got to be very cognizant about.
Agreed, Martin. We've had those recent examples with Colgate in China, and also Quaker Oats in the US, where we're looking at withdrawing brands because of racial stereotype within those brands, which I think is very interesting. Yeah,
it's a whole cleaning up, basically, of you know, how you are seen in the world, the impact that you've got on people. There's a sensitivity, particularly now, to being cognizant of what matters to any group of people, you know, in any particular way. And if you don't get it right, being very responsive, you know, as far as that's concerned. And we for the foreseeable future, are going to be in a period, I think, of accelerating turbulence. If you think about the pandemic, it's resurged again in Beijing as we speak. That's probably going to take us back then into an uncertain way to live our lives. It's going to accentuate this underlying anxiety. When we're anxious, we always seek voices that we can trust, full circle back into brands again. Brands need to find ways to harbor and safe harbor the loyalty that they have with their customers during this difficult period. And what we've just said is probably it's centered around the role that brands are being pulled into around the change that's happening in the world, a whole new dynamic that's taking place.
I think we could do a whole new podcast on that as well, Martin. As well. Now, we're certainly living in interesting times. Now, Martin, it's great to get your insight on that and, you know, on how organisations are responding to changing customer needs. Really interesting stuff. And looking forward, Martin, very much to our next conversation. Meantime, take care and stay safe.
It's an unfolding story, which is what makes these things interesting.
Absolutely. Thanks, Martin.